greetings once again to everybody out there in the greater Turdistan. This is your pal Turd. This is your TFMR A to A webinar for Thursday, October the 27th. And joining us today is a return appearance of our good friend John Butler. John is an American werewolf in London. I think I've actually referred to you that way before, John.
Indeed, you have.
Wow. Does anybody else ever refer to you that way?
No, actually, you're the first, although it is appropriate, I have to say.
Fair enough. All right. Like the Dr. Pepper. Remember the Dr. Pepper guy who played that role in the – anyway, I'm already getting sidetracked. All right. John has over 20 years of experience as a global investment strategist at such firms as Deutsche Bank and Lehman Brothers. So you can imagine we might have some conversation around that. But currently is he a head of wealth services at Gold Money, longtime friends of ours here at TF Metals Report. He's also author of the fantastic book, The Golden Revolution, which came out in 2012. But John has informed me that he is actively working to revise, extend, and update that book. And there will be a revision that will come out early in 2017. I encourage everybody to get a copy of it. And maybe not even wait. If you don't have the book yet, you should have read it. It's a wonderful book. So anyway, John, with that long and a glorious introduction, thank you very much for stopping by TFMR.
Again. Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
All right, my friend, let's dive right in, like I said. And for everybody listening, we use this format, this GoToWebinar format, so that you all can listen live. And then after I get done with some questions for John, all you have to do is click the questions tab on your GoToWebinar control panel and type in a question, and I will relay it to John, and he will answer it. But to begin with, John, I want to start with some of the exciting stuff that's going on at Gold Money. And for those of you that aren't familiar with what's been happening, you know, Gold Money was started by James Turk, whatever it is, 15, 20 years ago, a longstanding affiliation here of TFMR. But yet they combined, merged, bought out, whatever the right term is, BitGold. Gosh, John, what's that? Been at least a couple of years ago now, right?
Actually, it's only about 16 months.
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah, things have happened very quickly around here.
Yeah, that's just it. Well, all right, tell everybody there were some press releases that came out this week regarding BitGold and what now U.S. citizens can do with a BitGold account. Please tell everybody about that because you're a better expert at this than I.
Yes. Part of our value proposition is that we not only want to enable people to preserve wealth by being able to save in a very convenient and low-cost way in physical allocated gold, you know, thereby avoiding the increasingly prevalent risks of potential devaluation of currencies, default by governments or banks, clearly, you know, there are very, very good reasons, of which I'm sure your listeners are aware, why people should own gold. But the BitGold side of it, which we now call Gold Money Personal, because it has to do with our personal choices regarding how we conduct our financial affairs, we offer a payments network where you can transfer wealth between, you know, account to account, person to person inside of our network for zero cost. As long as the gold stays inside of the network, transfers are zero cost. And so that is a tremendous leap forward in terms of remonetizing money. Because if you think about it, you know, back in the day, if you were to make change for a 1 ounce gold coin and 10 one-tenth ounce gold coins, and just out of convenience purposes, you pass it back and forth, well, of course, between two individuals, that should be no cost. But sadly, the way the world works today, most gold transfers and of title or payments for services include a degree of friction or commission, but inside of our network, it's absolutely commission-free. It costs nothing. And we're able to do that because our financial technology is so advanced, our marginal costs of processing those sorts of transactions approach zero. So that's really our unique value proposition. There's no one else in the world that provides that kind of service. And in fact, because we've patented the technology, we would fully expect and hope that no one else will be providing that service because they'd be infringing on our intellectual property rights. So that's what we offer as a firm. we really believe that democratizing access to gold, making it available as a choice to individuals and now to businesses, is a big deal. Well, guess what? The U.S. regulators were the slowest amongst those we've already approached to embrace this and to allow it to occur. They just required a lot more documentation, explanation, you name it, to get comfortable that what we were doing was completely above board, could not be abused for, you know, whatever it is, money laundering, tax evasion. And the reason why is because we actually maintain, you know, very thorough records, and we do that in a very advanced way as well, using the latest sort of record-keeping technology, if you want to call it that. It's all created automatically when transactions take place. So we simply are embracing the world as it is and the regulatory requirements as they are, but the good news is they're now embracing us back. And so U.S. residents can now pay with gold, can transfer gold, can share gold, and they can do so in the lowest cost way that has ever existed in order to do so.
Fabulous. You know, and I've been such a big fan of this ever since the merger, because I thought, you know, here, you know, everybody saves money at a bank, and you're essentially loaning your money to the bank. In return, you're getting zero, maybe even negative interest now, and you're saving in fiat currency, which is constantly being devalued. And now here's a way to save and even pay your bills in gold. It just seems like a no-brainer, is it not? I mean, it's great.
Well, I mean, look, it certainly is for those of us who understand gold's unique monetary properties. It's the only money that does not decline in value. It's the only money that is almost costless to store because its density, its value density, is so high that even extremely, extremely high security storage is not expensive, because the volume, the area you have to make highly secure, is so small.
Yeah.
Now, I make this point to people now and again that, you know, if you want to protect a house, if you want to protect a farm, if you want to protect a productive resource, a factory, an oil field, whatever it is, it's extremely expensive to do so. Don't get me wrong, those things are productive and we need them, and I don't want to disparage them as essential elements of a modern economy, my God, but when it comes to pure wealth preservation, without default risk, without devaluation risk, there is simply no other substance known to man that has a higher density of value than physical concentrated gold. And as long as you construct your vaulting facilities using, you know, the best available technology, which our vault providers do, well then, believe it or not, storage costs they approach zero. So in a world of zero interest rates, it is a no-brainer. Fully agreed.
And every ounce, every gram for that matter, that an individual holds, owns at gold money is 100% fully allocated, right?
Absolutely. And that is audited by KPMG every quarter. The actual digital ledger is printed out in physical paper form twice a day at each vault location. So if, God forbid, the internet even goes down, the vault knows what belongs to whom. And you can literally go to the vault physically and present proof of identification so they know who you are, and they will give you your gold. We go out of our way to make sure that, you know, short of, you know, God forbid, you know, nuclear war, you know, awful, I mean, truly awful scenarios, that the gold will be accessible in extremis, notwithstanding the possibility that some of these, you know, who knows, you know, internet or other traumatic events might happen.
And we all know here at this site, I mean, the only way we're going to break the bank, the banks, if you will, the bullion banks, and break their paper derivative pricing scheme and all of the terrible effects it's had on everybody from all of us investors down to just the miners and their families. The only way we're going to break it is through physical gold demand, breaking this paper scheme. And anything we can do to help increase physical demand, man, we are all over it. And using gold money, 100% allocated, get it out of the system, get it out of the bank's hands. Boy, anything that we can do to help you grow, anything that any news development that we see that helps you grow, like this one. It's great. So please keep going, John. I just want to give it a big thumbs up to everybody.
Well, it's kind of a funny sign of the times, though, when you think about it, that the U.S. was the last major country.
Yeah.
Leave China aside because they've got capital controls. But if you talk about countries that don't have capital controls, the U.S. was the last major country to allow us to offer this service in their territory. And, you know, for a country that purports to be free market, et cetera, the fact that the U.S. was the last major country we could get to agree to this is, that's a bit sad on the one hand. On the other hand, as you say, it is a big hurdle that we've managed to jump.
Yep.
And we're just going to keep running. We have a saying at Gold Money, you know, Uber is the world's most valuable taxi company. They own no taxis. Airbnb is the world's most valuable hotel company. They own no hotels. Amazon's the world's most valuable retailer. They own no retail shops. You know, Gold Money is the world's most valuable independent, that is non-bank, gold custodian. We don't own any gold. The fact is we're simply enabling people to use technology in ways they weren't able to before. And in the same way Uber and Airbnb and Amazon have had to fight their regulatory battles, not just in the U.S., but other countries, in order to get to where they are, yeah, we have to fight ours too. But guess what? All of us, them and us, we're all winning the battles. Why? Because we live in the age of choice. Governments find it very difficult to say you should be able to choose your lifestyle on the one hand, but you can't choose what you do commercially on the other. It's inconsistent, it's ridiculous, it's archaic, and it's just dumb. And so we are really making a lot of progress, but we're part of this wave. It's not just us. It's this wave of choice, which is sweeping over a lot of government bureaucracy and, you know, resistance to what, you know, people want to choose, be it a taxi, a hotel, a retail choice, or how to save and transact in real money.
Yep. Fabulous. Fabulous. All right, my friend, I want to, I've got a couple questions already stacking up, and I'm going to be respectful of your time, so I better just dive right in. The one thing that I wanted to ask you as we get started is I do want to draw upon your experience. I mean, you're there in London. You have experience working at Lehman back in the day and Deutsche Bank as well. And gosh, there have been so many concerns about Deutsche Bank's liquidity and their derivative exposure and all of that over the last, well, really this entire year, 2016, Deutsche Bank started falling off a cliff in January. It kind of came to a head again in the last couple of weeks. I just wanted to pick your brain, knowing what you know about those companies. How similar are they, and how similar is the situation, or is there any similarities at all?
Well, this is where you have to be careful whether you're speaking in generalities or specifics. I have no privileged specific information vis-a-vis Deutsche Bank. I have not worked there for years. Yes, I do still know some people who work there, but of course they would not be at liberty to share any privileged information sure. with me. But I will say the following. There are eerie general similarities, and Deutsche Bank, as a derivatives counterparty, not just to, you know, German banks or European banks, but the world at large, is an order of magnitude larger than Lehman Brothers. I can't stress that point enough, okay? Deutsche, its derivatives book, vis-a-vis, you know, the general counterparty in derivative books of large banks generally, is simply an order of magnitude larger than Lehman's ever was.
General.
And that doesn't mean I'm predicting that Deutsche Bank's going to blow up. They might not. However, the potential for them to wreak serious financial havoc around the world, if things do go wrong in the end, is much larger than Lehman. I mean, much. And when you think about how the euro area as a monetary area is already so shaky, it's so uncertain, it's still clearly an experiment, there's huge conflicts across national borders and between the ECB and domestic economic and financial ministers of parliament and whatnot, the pure uncertainty is actually bigger again, by an order of magnitude than Lehman. But then where there's smoke, there's fire. You now see a disturbing series of decisions being made by Deutsche Bank's counterparties, be the other banks, be the institutional investors, to start withdrawing credit lines, to start withdrawing deposits, to start withdrawing money. Deutsche Bank has become a distressed institution. There is simply no other term that can be applied. It is distressed. Its market valuations are distressed, its credit spreads are distressed, and the way people talk about it is distressed. That doesn't mean it will blow up tomorrow, and it doesn't mean that it won't be bailed out. Maybe it will be. Germany actually is a country with deep pockets, and if they said, you know what, we just want to nationalize this bank, they could do it. That said, that really opens the can of worms, because the moment Deutsche Bank takes a national decision to bail out a failing bank, if Germany, you know, bails out Deutsche as a national decision, well, then that's a precedent that every other country in the euro area can just say, oh, hey, we're going to do that with our banks too.
Yeah.
The problem is that requires a huge issuance of debt at the sovereign level to recapitalize the banks. And that massive explosion of debt is incompatible with a monetary union. It just is. You can't have everyone issuing debt willy-nilly to bail out failing banks willy-nilly and still claim you're in some sort of coordinated monetary union with a single monetary policy. It does not work. It will be the end of the euro experiment. And so I believe Germany will be very hesitant to simply outright bail out Deutsche Bank. They're going to try Band-Aid after Band-Aid after Band-Aid. Of course, that only buys time, maybe not a lot of time. And exactly what happens in the end, I don't know. But this could well be the beginning of the end of the euro experiment.
Well, that's a great segue to the first of two questions that I had emailed to me from folks that had questions but couldn't join us today. And again, I want to invite anybody listening, if you have a question for John, we'll get to those in a second. Just open up your questions tab on your GoToWebinar control panel and type it in. But John, like I said, that's a great segue to a question that was emailed to me from a guy named Chris, who just wanted to get your opinion on this idea of contagion between the Eurozone banks. How real is that possibility that one bank, he mentions Deutsche Bank, but I'd throw in, you know, like a Monty Paschi as well, that one bank, because of the interconnectedness, could bring down all the rest?
Well, history is instructive in this regard. And just for fun, let's go back to 1931. Now, in 1931, Europe, in aggregate, was already in, you know, a deep, deep recession. They were suffering, you know, massively for all kinds of reasons that were related to the mayhem post-First World War. But of course, as we know, the U.S. was already slipping into the Great Depression. They didn't call it that at the time. No one realized in 1931 just how bad things were going to get.
Yeah.
By 1933-34, when, oh my God, I mean, you know, President Roosevelt and others were staring into the abyss. So in 1931, you know, things in the U.S. still sort of felt like, okay, gee, they're not great. The stock market's crashing, but the economy is at least sort of half holding up, and it's not the end of the world, at least not yet. But then guess what happens in 1931? An Austrian bank, Austria. Now, this is Austria. Austria has, the Austrian Empire has been broken up, right? It was broken up in 1919, so what's left of Austria is tiny. But okay, there's this Austrian bank called Kreditanstalt. And in 1931, for reasons that, you know, I don't need to go into the details, they basically become insolvent. And they simply cannot, you know, meet their creditors' demands. And they fail. Literally within weeks, all of a sudden, this cascade of failures shows up in the U.S. banking system. And it just cascades through, and all of a sudden it's failure, 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 failure. And as 1932 rolls along, banks are failing left, right, and center. And then, of course, Roosevelt's campaign to succeed Hoover, which takes place, you know, during that year, 1932, is largely predicated on the idea that, oh, Hoover's doing nothing, Hoover's doing nothing, Hoover is doing nothing, and I will do something. Now, how was Roosevelt able to get away with that? Because the mainstream economy had not yet crashed. It was the banks beginning to fail, however, that was beginning to unfold, and Roosevelt played it for all it was worth. And guess what? The trigger for that was an Austrian bank failing. If it could happen then, if you could get contagion back in 1931 from an Austrian bank to the United States, then think about today when globalization has, of course, gone an order of magnitude farther, when all the banks are totally sewed up together as counterparties far, far more across borders. Today, my God, the transmission mechanisms are so much stronger. If it could happen then, it could happen now. It would happen faster. It would be quicker, more severe. It would permeate things even further. So that's just using a bit of historical analogy. There's another argument to make, which is simply that, of course, the global banking system, and including that of the U.S., is more poorly capitalized. You know, fractional reserve banking, disguised leverage, shadow banking, all kinds of, you know, innovative, let's put that in quotation marks because it might not be very good, but innovative financial practices, derivatives that Warren Buffett once called weapons of mass destruction. These things are all far more prevalent today, and we know that, and we can quantify that, whereas they were almost non-existent back in 1931. So, look, if it could happen then, oh my God, could it happen now? Yep. And nobody, even the regulators, don't know what they're dealing with. They haven't learned from history, and they don't understand how to quantify the risks of these exotic derivatives that are so prevalent today on Deutsche's balance sheet, on other banks' balance sheets, etc.
They haven't learned from their 1931 history, but yet, and I guess that shouldn't be a surprise because they haven't learned from their 2008 history.
No, indeed. And this is one of those fun quotes, right? You know, what we learn from history is that we don't learn from history. It's a truism, and it demonstrates itself now and again, and it's doing so again as we speak.
Yep. Okay, next question that I had emailed to me comes from Jay Quest. And this is an interesting question. This is something that is kind of bubbling behind the scenes that I had to even go up and look for a link on this to remind myself about this. And the link will be included on this podcast page so people can read about it if they are not familiar with it. What I'm getting at is this ongoing discussion in the Islamic world to kind of issue some proclamations and statements to make gold investing and gold speculation, even if you will, okay for followers of Islam. At present, you can own gold and you can transact in gold. I guess it's okay for a Muslim to do that. But to speculate, to own gold as an investment that you can eventually then, you know, trade into something else is basically not okay. And so if I'm summarizing that right, Jay Quest's question is, do you, John, have any feel for what the impact on the gold price will be? Because this is happening even later this year, next year, as Muslim law is changed to allow gold investment for 1.2 billion Muslims worldwide.
Yes, we're actually aware of this, by the way, and we're excited about it.
Yeah.
Because the thing is that the gold trade in that part of the world is still largely just hand-to-hand physical gold trade. And while I have nothing against that in principle, let's face it, it's not as efficient as being able to trade gold in a more digital, electronic way using modern technology. And of course, we as a firm, we have cutting-edge technology in that regard, and we're the market leader in that regard. And so for us, this is extremely exciting because, as you say, over 1 billion people may soon be allowed to take advantage of cutting-edge financial digital gold technology in a way they weren't able to before and in a way which is outright encouraged. And we're just sitting there waiting. We're not just waiting. Waiting is the wrong word, but we're, you know, preparing for this unlocking, as it were, of a huge part of the world in a way that we think can only be to the benefit of our business. Now, that said, I don't want to simply talk our own book. It's to the benefit of the entire world. The fact is, gold is money. It's money for the reasons we already discussed. It doesn't decay. It's cheap to store. It can't be arbitrarily devalued. I mean, who on earth wants to use a money that can be arbitrarily devalued? It can't be defaulted on. I mean, come on. Who wants to use a money that can be defaulted on? It is proper, as Alan Greenspan said, ultimate money. And if 1 billion more people around the world are able to use that money in a modern, digital, integrated way with the rest of the world, that will only help to transform the international monetary system back to some, you know, certainly greater focus and attention and remonetization of actual physical gold.
Yeah.
I couldn't welcome it, you know, more if I could. I mean, it's a wonderful development. In the same way that when China finally decided to ditch communism and re-enter the global economy, and by doing so added about something on the order of 600 million workers to the labor force in just 20 years. I mean, that was one of the greatest positive economic shocks ever in history, and I experienced it in my lifetime. Why do you think all this stuff is so cheap? I've got this massive flat screen TV across the office here. I mean, it costs, what was it, $250?
Yeah.
Hello? Would that have been possible had China never chosen to re-enter the global economy? Well, certainly not as quickly.
Yeah.
This is kind of similar, but from a monetary angle. How wonderful that 1 billion people are going to start demanding hard money again. I think it's great.
Well, that's a segue to one of the questions that I have in the queue from people that are listening. And it gets to that idea of a gold-backed currency, because as you're talking, I'm thinking, why is this happening now? Why is this being almost kind of rushed through that the Sharia, I don't want to call it Sharia law, but the laws of Sharia or however the right way that that's put, is being changed to allow Muslims to speculate and invest in gold. And again, to me, then all of a sudden I started thinking about this question about the gold-backed currency, because in your book, you had mentioned that, you know, that, you know, what happens one day when all of a sudden a country or group of countries suddenly announces an alternative to the dollar in the form of a gold-backed or asset-backed currency. The question from the listener is that, what is the probability of that happening at this point, and what would happen the next day after something like that was announced?
Well, look, obviously one has to, you know, speculate a bit about something like that. As far as the probability of it happening, that a country or a group of countries decide that they will in fact begin using gold in an official capacity as money, say for settling international trade, you know, getting people to pay for their exports in gold rather than paper, I think that's inevitable. And I use that word in my book, and I'm still very confident using that word. I look at the monetary cycles of history, of which there have been many, and they all go the same way in the end. They all go from money, which becomes corrupted and printed and devalued. They eventually make their way back around the circle to gold.
Yep.
In every instance. And I just don't see why our present cycle will end up going in a fundamentally different way. In fact, I see lots of evidence it's going in precisely the same way.
Yeah.
However, it is worth speculating a bit more specifically about how, given the, you know, the current structure of the international system, the international monetary conventions, how that might go. I guess, ultimately, I kind of feel that you simply have this non-linear dynamic where every state or even non-state actor that decides to either save or otherwise conduct a certain portion of its financial affairs in gold, it forces everyone else to take up the slack. Whoever wants to continue to perpetuate the fiat system will have to actually accumulate more fiat in order to keep fiat stable versus gold. And that's the nonlinear aspect of it. And eventually, of course, you have enough people smelling smoke in the theater that one person actually stands up and makes for the exit. And then, of course, what was a linear dynamic of people incrementally smelling smoke becomes a nonlinear dynamic, because the moment someone makes for the exit, everyone rushes up and follows, whether they themselves ever smelled the smoke or not. I don't know where that point lies, and I'm terribly sorry. I kind of, in a way, I wish I did, because I'd probably become a very rich man if I could time anything so precisely. But that's the dynamic. That's the way we need to understand it. And whether you know, Russia and China are first movers to officially remonetize gold, whether a future U.S. President or other or congressional leadership has the enlightenment to see that, in fact, constitutional gold slash silver money is better than the what we got today, and moves and acts on that, whether the Arab world, the Sharia world, as you say, acts on it, whether private individuals simply vote with their gold. You know what? I don't know what it's going to be, and it may be some combination of all of the above, but I have tremendous faith when I look at these monetary cycles of history that this is where we're going, yeah, one way or another.
No, I agree with you. I mention it all the time here about the idea that people need to understand that tomorrow is not always going to be just like yesterday. And in our lifetime, all that anyone has known is a dollar reserve standard. You know, I mean, as long as you were born after 1930, your adult years, you've never known anything but. There aren't a lot of people left alive that were born before 1930.
Well, I mean, to give some credit to a friend of mine, you know, you've probably interviewed James Rickards in the past. Or at a minimum, you've mentioned his work. And he has a very interesting story to tell, because he went, you know, he studied economics before he studied international law. He studied economics, and he claims that the year that he graduated with a bachelor's degree in economics, which I think was 1974, he claims that was the last year that studying the history of the international monetary system, that is the gold standard, was part of the curriculum at his university. And apparently the very next year, they just dropped it, because they sort of felt it's not relevant anymore. We've got a new system. Who cares about the history? And I just think that's unbelievable. I mean, just the fact that a reputable U.S. university would just say, well, you know what, now that we've dropped gold and the gold standard, there's no point teaching monetary history anymore.
Correct.
That's outrageous.
Yeah, you're right.
But he claims that it literally happened right around the time he was graduating. Just astonishing. Astonishing interest.
All right. Well, John, again, you're being very generous with your time, but I know you don't have much time left. So I've got one more question in queue, and then we'll get to the final four. This comes from Larry, who is a Gold Money customer and loves the service, and has a question. Says he's going to be in Mexico in a few months. Can he use his BitGold card there? And then additionally, if he renews his passport, should he upload the new one to the site?
Okay. Both very good questions. The first one, if his Gold Money card is denominated as a base currency U.S. dollar card, because our cards, even though they will debit your gold to make payments when necessary, they make it through the designated base currency first. That's the way they're set up. If it's a U.S. dollar base currency card, then what will happen is, if he makes a payment in Mexico, the card will, as required, sell some of his gold, but initially for dollars, and then sell the dollars for Mexican pesos as per MasterCard policy to be able to make a payment in local currency. Mm-hmm. And so there may be, depending on the issuer of the MasterCard, there may be an FX transaction fee, because some credit card companies charge that, others don't. MasterCard is simply the card provider. Remember, they don't provide the credit. It's always a bank.
Right.
MasterCard is the payments protocol. The bank is the one doing the FX transaction. MasterCard is not. And so it simply depends on his own bank's policy. Some banks charge minimal foreign exchange fees. Other banks charge exorbitant foreign exchange fees. So I would recommend to Larry that he inquire with his provider of that MasterCard, you know, whichever U.S. bank it presumably is, what sort of fee they charge for typical FX transactions between dollars and pesos. If those transactions are very low, then it will be very convenient and low cost to use the card. If the transaction fees are high, then he might want to consider another option. But see, that part of it's outside of our control. We're not able to tell correspondent banks in locations around the world what to do.
Right.
We simply have an arrangement with MasterCard. MasterCard is the one that then makes the arrangement with local correspondent banks for the foreign exchange transactions. It's in MasterCard's hands at that point, not ours. We use our own technology to do what we do to make it as low cost as possible. We're not responsible for any extra extra layer of friction on top of that required by the banks.
What's the passport part of that?
Yes, the passport answer. We do require up-to-date documents because we're a regulated institution. We're regulated because that's the only way we're allowed to be directly interfacing with the banking system, to be able to deal with institutional clients, so on and so forth. Any identity document which is less than 3 months from expiry should be updated in the documentation. And we do have relationship managers who can help clients to do that. So if a passport is less than 3 months from expiry, if a proof of address, driver's license, whatever you're using, is less than 3 months from expiry, then yes, we strongly recommend you update it as soon as possible. Otherwise, you do run the risk that it could happen, sadly, a transaction is declined.
Kind of like,
so 3 months is the cutoff.
Is it kind of like in the U.S., you know, the Patriot Act stuff where you have to, you know, money laundering and all that kind of stuff?
This is actually a worldwide thing because no matter where you go in the world, even if you're simply traveling, much less transacting, any proof of identity which is less than 3 months from expiry tends to meet with resistance.
Got it.
And that's because a typical visa convention for travel tends to be 90 days. And the idea is that if you're still in the country when that proof of identity, passport, whatever, does expire, then you end up in a real pickle, and nobody, you know, wants you to end up in that situation. So there's nothing nefarious about this. This is not, I think, a heavy-handed regulation necessarily. It's just kind of the way cross-border travel and business is done. It's just a convention. And so, yes, if you're inside of that three-month window, I do recommend you upload new docs, and that will prevent any nasty surprises while you're traveling around the world.
Awesome. John, I want to thank you for your time. I know it's a little after 6 in London, so, I mean, it's dinner time, and you've got a family and all that kind of stuff. So at this point, we'll call it a day. But before you go, I've got to ask you the traditional final four, just four quickies before you exit. You can usually answer in a word or a sentence. If you're ready, can I hit you with them?
Absolutely. Let's go.
All right. With this pending Brexit stuff next year, you know, and all the swirling, oh boy, what's going to happen? Are you stocking up on Marmite?
Ha! It's funny you say that because, yes, Marmite is a very popular spread on toast here in the UK. And Unilever, which is a Dutch company, have asked to the local supermarkets to raise the price on Marmite by a double-digit amount because of this large devaluation of sterling that's taken place so far this year. And in a way, they have every right to do so. Why shouldn't they, right? They're a global company, and sterling is weaker, so of course they should be allowed to charge a higher price. But that's kind of met with outrage because Marmite is perceived in the UK to be a national food. So the idea that a non-UK company would raise prices is just so funny. In any event, it's made for an interesting political football here, which is being kicked all around.
I would imagine.
What I would say is that this is the beginning of something bigger, right? This is the beginning of something bigger. It's prices in this country, in the UK, are going to soar next year as a result of the very large devaluation of sterling we've seen. Marmite is simply the beginning. So do not only stock up on Marmite, stock up on any relatively non-perishable item, because it's only going to get worse, basically.
Yeah, good advice. All right, number two, have you ever taken the wife and kids down to ride the eye?
Yes, indeed. We were invited to a birthday party, actually. Was it a year before last? And what's nice about the capsules, they call them that because that's how they're shaped, that circle around the wheel, you can get them catered, and you can have a small bar and canapes, and that's kind of how this was done. And I have to say, it's a delightful way to do it because you get to see London. Yeah. It's particularly nice around sunset time, and if you've got cocktails and canapes, well, you know, what's not to like? And even children love it, right? They're leaning against the glass walls of the capsules, looking straight down and giggling while the adults are enjoying their cocktails and canapes. Good fun's had by all, let me tell you.
Dude, let me tell you though, I couldn't get off that thing fast enough.
Okay.
I was glad when it was fun. It was pure, beautiful, great view. I was glad to be done. All right, next. Who was the best James Bond so far?
Look, I know that it's only natural that people defer to Sean Connery as the original, and that's the easy answer, right? I mean, you know, no one's ever going to really have a go at you for having made that claim. However, if you read Fleming's novels, if you actually read the books, you realize that Bond's character is, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying Sean Connery didn't come close, but actually, Daniel Craig comes even closer in terms of how he actually acts, his much more serious, his much more, you know, in a way, Sean Connery was a product of the 60s.
Yeah.
Daniel Craig actually is more true to form. So don't get me wrong, I love Sean Connery, but if you read the actual books, you have to agree, and I feel strongly about this, you have to agree that Daniel Craig actually is true to form above and beyond what Connery ever achieved.
We got to get him back for another one. All right, and lastly, the dreaded U.S. presidential election now looms in just 12 days. Who's going to win?
The short answer is I don't know. But what I will tell you is this. Having experienced the whole Brexit phenomenon earlier this year in the UK, with all the polls having suggested that Remain would win and Brexit would lose, and then the result being quite decisive the other way, I have a sense that traditional polling techniques simply fail to properly measure political events that cut across lines, that realign and reorder issues and loyalties. I kind of feel Reagan demonstrated that because he was behind in the polls too. And I think that Trump also fits that category. Now, that doesn't mean I think he's going to win. It looks like Hillary's got the machine behind her, the media behind her, the money behind her, Wall Street behind her, the DC elite behind her, and so on and so forth. But I would not believe the polls. I think the polls are untrustworthy. And that doesn't mean they're deliberately untrustworthy. I just think traditional polling techniques struggle and fail to capture these sorts of dynamics. We saw it with Brexit. We saw it with Reagan. We saw it with Dewey defeats Truman. Duh, not the other way around. And we might see it again.
Yeah, I agree. It's going to be an interesting 12 days. And actually, by the next time we visit, which will hopefully be soon, it'll all be behind us. So we'll have the answer to that. But in the meantime, John, I can't thank you enough for your time today. This has been tremendous. And I know everybody that is listening, but then the multiples larger that will hear it in the recorded version, I think are enriched by hearing from you. So thank you so much for spending some time. And at this point, I'll give you the rest of the day off.
Thanks, Craig. Always a pleasure. Okay, thank you very much.
And everybody out there, we'll do this again next week. But in the meantime, please check out Gold Money and consider an account there if you don't already have one. They are a big asset in the fight against the banks and provide a great service. So please check them out. John, thanks again. Have a great rest of your day.
Thanks. Same to you.